Welcome to On the Record with Furniture Today, a podcast that goes behind the headlines to look at the news and the newsmakers, the people and the personalities that give the furniture industry its unique flavor. I'm your host, Bill McLaughlin, Editor-in-Chief of Furniture Today. My guest this week is Dave Perry, Executive Editor and Bedding Guru for Furniture Today. Dave, welcome.
Welcome. Am I a personality or where do I fall on that list? several categories.
There you go. You're a unique personality, an industry leader, a guru of bedding. I'll invent some more titles by the time we get done.
I like it.
So you have been covering a boatload of news lately. Obviously, the most recent is IMS and the unique situation that they are in with Tempur Sealy. What'd you make of that?
You know, it is, what's the saying? Never a dull day. It's a quiet Friday, and next thing I know, Tempur Sealy is announcing that they're going to provide $14 million of debtor-in-possession financing. It's pretty rare to see a supplier provide DIP financing, so that caught my attention. And, you know, in terms of the Chapter 11, it's kind of funny. In the old days, Chapter 11 was the kiss of death. In the new days, Chapter 11 is simply a business reorganization. When IMS announced this, they talked about they're in a transformation process. So they didn't even use the word Chapter 11. Right at the beginning of their announcement, that came later, but they emphasized they're in a transformation process, which they are. And interestingly, another significant bedding retailer, Mattress Firm, was in Chapter 11 last fall and has already exited. So if the question is, what's going on in the bedding category, a number of things are going on. Matt Firm and IMS are very different companies. The standard thinking on Mattress Firm is they simply had too many stores, 3,000 plus. In contrast, IMS has 142 stores, I believe. So it's not so much store size there. But Scott Thompson, when he announced the Tempur Sealy, when he announced the $14 million of DIP, he said a couple interesting things. He said that IMS had an overextended retail footprint. Now, that would be a similarity to Matt Firm. And then he said they also had a, quote, thin capital structure.
I read that too, and I thought that was really interesting. I'm wondering in what way are they undercapitalized? And in what way can you solve that problem? What do they need capital for exactly? Especially if it sounds like he thinks they have too many stores.
You know, good question. And one of the nice things, I shouldn't say nice, but maybe from a journalist's point of view, one thing about Chapter 11 filings is we get a glimpse inside the company. IMS, privately held company. So we will get probably a better idea as we go through documents maybe on what some of those issues are. I don't know offhand what they need the money for other than Scott Thompson does talk about they were not, he said their capital structure was not designed, quote, to effectively respond to the competitive pressures of the recent retail environment. So does that mean they were not scaled appropriately to work in the online world?
It's certainly the question that it raises, isn't it? Because,
yeah.
I mean, if you look at what the bedding industry has been going through in the last year or two, most of the disruption that we've talked about seems to be coming in the online space. And I think as you've reported on in a lot of different cases, people used to think that it was much cheaper to play online and that brick and mortar was, you know, you had overhead and those, so all of these, D2C guys could come in and compete for a song. But the reality is that it's very expensive from an advertising standpoint. And some of these companies spend enormous amounts of money trying to get their brand and their names and their product in front of consumers. So I'm wondering if A, it's a matter of capitalizing to compete more effectively online. That takes a lot of software, a lot of technology. We've reported about Ashley. They have spent hundreds of millions of dollars over the last couple of years to try to bring their technology to become a state-of-the-art player. And I wonder if that's the question. Certainly in lieu of Scott Thompson's comment there about being overstored and undercapitalized, I suspect that would mean perhaps fewer stores and a bigger online presence.
I would, you know, another, I would think that too. Another interesting thought here is what is going to happen with this? What is the next step for IMS? And a couple of analysts, one analyst is actually saying he thinks it's the next step is that Tempur Sealy will acquire IMS. Now another analyst says no, he doesn't think so. But I suppose it's not much of a stretch to say, if Tempur Sealy is providing $14 million now, and that they, one of the analysts says they don't really have a lot of distribution alternatives in the states, the southeastern region that IMS serves. So it may be, defensively, it may be a good idea for them to acquire them. Now, the negative side there is, what do other Tempur Sealy dealers think about that? And they probably wouldn't be thrilled. However, if there are not a lot of those dealers in that area, then maybe that does work out. In addition, Tempur Sealy is expanding their retail footprint to try to make up for the loss of Mattress Firm. So they have been on an aggressive retail push. They're opening their own stores. This would be consistent with that for them to take a stake in a retailer like IMS. So, what's the cliche? We live in interesting times. We're gonna have to see. They do talk about Kim Kanoff of IMS talks about coming out of this in the first half. So, we shouldn't have to wait all that long to have some idea what might happen.
Well, you know, this notion of suppliers playing in the retail space seems to be coming more and more prevalent in the industry. I mean, you think of the historic Ethan Allen model, right? I mean, that's a vertical integration from the manufacturing side right to the consumer. You think of what Ashley has been doing over the last several years, Lazy Boy has been doing, Bassett has been doing, and then you look at Lazy Boy acquiring Joybird, which right. is acquiring that expertise and that direct-to-the-consumer expertise.
The clicks expertise. Well, another key example in the mattress arena there is Serta Simmons Bedding acquiring Tuft & Needle. Now, what's kind of problematic about that is Tuft & Needle has had a very aggressive in-your-face message, namely, mattress stores are greedy. Well, suddenly they're paired with a company that serves a lot of mattress stores. So perhaps perhaps mattress stores aren't as greedy now as they were.
No, and maybe sheep are not greedy at all. And so
I can
see that commercial sheep jumping over, giving the consumers money instead of mattresses.
Maybe sheep play well with others.
It certainly is an interesting time in the business. It seems to be an interesting time, particularly for mattress specialty stores. Even though Mattfirm had a different set of challenges, it does seem like the mattress specialty channel is perhaps somewhat more directly affected at this time than other channels of distribution. Is that your sense from talking to retailers and manufacturers? Is that a channel that needs to do some realignment?
Well, I guess one of the things about the mattress specialty store channel is the positive of that is all they have to talk about is mattresses. But the negative is they've got to figure the mattress piece out. And the mattress piece of the equation has been under challenge with the direct-to-consumer guys, as you mentioned. And I think I'm not sure that any of the mattress specialty stores, the brick-and-mortar retailers, have figured out the whole online piece. Mattress Firm, it's a fairly small part of their business overall. You talked a while earlier about acquisition costs. I've told they're maybe almost doubled in the past couple of years. It's getting very expensive to acquire online consumers. So I think the mattress specialty stores, that is the heart of their business. So, I mean, another thing we could talk about for a second is this whole issue of traffic. I mean, everyone says traffic is down. Well, if you're a mattress specialty store, what does it mean if your traffic's down? I mean, that's you're living and dying on mattresses, and you don't have anything else to drive traffic. So you've got to focus on what you can do there. And at the upcoming Las Vegas market, there's going to be some talk about programs to try to drive traffic. But that's a tough thing to do. And another issue is, I think brick-and-mortar retailers, and I'd be interested in your take on this, brick-and-mortar retailers tend to think of their traffic as brick-and-mortar traffic. Shouldn't online traffic count as well? If a store is if their brick and mortar traffic is down, but their online traffic is up, is it really accurate to say that their traffic is down?
Steve Rotman has done a lot of analysis of that, and I think you remember he spoke at last year, 2017, not 2018's betting conference.
Or leadership conference.
Leadership conference, yep. I'm sorry. Maybe I'm being prophetic. Who knows what the
future
holds?
You are. You're predicting. So you've got a speaker for me already.
But, you know, he takes a much more integrative view of online and bricks and clicks. And the other thing is that in the furniture space, I've heard people say their traffic is down, but their conversions are up. So when the consumer comes into the store, it's not coming in saying, I'm looking for a sofa, but it's coming in saying, I'm looking for, you know, the company X number 1, 2, 3 model sofa. And so they're really pre-sold.
Well, is another way to look at that the tire kickers have dropped off, but maybe do you think we still have the same number of serious shoppers? Does it really matter if the not really good customers or just people that are wandering in, does it matter if we strip those away? I mean, I don't know. I know the retailers that I talk to are distressed to talk about their traffic being off. They don't seem to differentiate it into good prospects and bad prospects, but I think you're making a great point. If people come in and really know what they want, you could argue that the whole retail experience is a much more efficient one now because people come in knowing what they want. They're able to, retailers perhaps can more quickly zero in and meet those needs versus in the old days, you know, why are you here? What are you doing? Tempur Sealy has some great thoughts on this with their new Retail Edge program. And they say one of the key things to say now is where are you in the shopping process? As the first question, and that is a great question because you're acknowledging there's a process. And if someone says, "Well, I'm just getting started," okay, that's really good to know. If someone says, "Well, I've been looking around," but that is a great question to kind of find out in the new reality where people are. If they've done no homework at all, that'll probably come out right away. If they're really serious, if they say, "Hey, I've been looking at Casper." But I mean, I think that is a great question, and there's kind of this new reality that it's a process. The mattress retailers, the goal used to be close the sale today. And Tempur Sealy says in their research for Retail Edge, actually, a lot of times people do come back. The famous B-backs actually do come back. There's always a debate about that. There's been a fear if someone says, "I'll be back," that they'll never come back. Have you seen any of that in your own talks with retailers as well?
Yes. I think the psychology, I want to just circle back to that question because I think the psychology of that question is brilliant. If you look at what so many of the D2C players, both in bedding and in furniture, they really play off that traditional consumer fear of having a salesman kind of just swoop down on them, right, and attack them and ask them all kinds of questions. And that where are you in the process? It's a very non-threatening question. It gives you the ability to say, "Oh, well," even the chance to show off, right? "Well, we've looked at this, and we've looked at that, and we've looked at it," or, "Well, we're really just beginning." And so it's a really outstanding conversation starter.
Well, and you know, what are some of the classic questions? What size are you looking for? Is this for you? I mean, an absolute no-no. What kind of budget do you have? Let's go ahead and stereotype that, or let's put them in a price straitjacket. So those are some of the old school questions, and I think realizing that it's a process is brilliant, and it is a process. The TSI research shows, by the way, that this can go on for hundreds of days. Think about that. This could be a very lengthy process, which is both good and bad. I mean, maybe the bad part for retailers is they've got to promote consistently. If someone's going to consider a mattress purchase for a couple hundred days, that says the retailer really has to be promoting that they're out there almost all the time. One of the advantages bedding specialty stores have had is they've always been heavy promoters. They've always, I think, out-promoted furniture stores. But if the process is a lengthy one, maybe that makes it even more important for advertising.
Well, that raises a lot of questions around how we track success. And if you think about it, most RSAs are probably judged and compensated on how you do in any given week, how you do in any given month.
Yep.
And the notion that a process could take 100 or more days, a third of the year, that suggests an entirely different set of metrics.
Well, it does. And does someone remember who they first talked to versus who they closed the sale with? I mean, those would be challenging issues for a retailer. I mean, it's probably one thing if you come in on Friday and buy on Monday. They can probably figure that out. The person that greets you, who greeted you 6 months ago, may not even be there.
And would you even remember in some cases?
Would you? Yeah. So what kind of systems would they have for tracking that? They might have to take a more holistic approach. I was in a pizza restaurant the other day that instead of leaving the tip on the table, they had a jar for tips at the counter. So maybe everyone gets tipped in a way and not the individual salesperson. I mean, I don't know, but those are interesting questions retailers probably need to give some thought to.
Well, this goes back to the store traffic question, too. The traditional metrics of success don't seem to apply anymore. And so I think we have an industry that's not just struggling with continuing its sales momentum, but looking at how it evaluates itself, looking at the numbers that it uses to track its own success, to track its employees' success. I think that in itself is probably as disruptive as anything else.
Well, it is. One other point on what Steve Rotman said. I think Steve's got a brilliant point that you need to consider both online and in-store traffic. But I can tell you that is not a prevalent view of among the mattress retailers I talk to. And it almost makes me want to ask them, you know, are you tracking your online traffic? Do you realize online is not just a bonus? I mean, I think Steve said online is the equivalent of your front door. So, okay, what's your online front door look like? And I think Steve's exactly right. You have to add all that together. But you also have to have, I guess, a fairly vibrant way to sell online. That's part of the point if you're going to say that the online is the front door. A lot of retailers responding to our surveys have said they don't even sell mattresses online. A majority have said they don't, which is kind of shocking because it's pretty clear that you can have online success in mattresses.
Well, you know, and the flip side of that is that we've seen a lot of activity going the other way, right? With some of these boxed bed players who have gotten their, kind of cut their teeth, made a name for themselves online. You know, so much we were talking as if it's an either or, right?
Right.
You're either going to shop in clicks or you're either going to shop in bricks. But it looks like a lot of the D2C guys are now starting to move into the brick and mortar space.
You know, it does. And the best example of that probably is Casper, everyone's favorite disruptor. It's funny, Amazon is a much stronger, bigger player than Casper, but everyone in bedding kind of says Casper's their number one enemy. It's really Amazon. As Keith Koenig said at the leadership conference, you know, it's Wayfair and Amazon are the real challenges that everybody has to confront. But Casper, back to them, has said they're going to open 200 stores in the next couple of years. That'll be a fascinating development if they actually do that. They have a couple of stores now, or a handful. I've been in stores in New York and one in Atlanta. They're small. They're kind of fun. They're so much smaller than a normal mattress store. They might have 5 beds, something like that. They're in little bays. You can close the curtains and take a nap, which they said people do. I think that is a brilliant concept. Casper has the Dreamery, and I think is it Greenwich Village or
Soho?
Soho, yeah, somewhere
so
up there.
So many concepts opening in Soho. It's become a real retail
testing. And you know New York City, so. But they have, you can actually go in there and sign up to take naps. And I've long said to mattress specialty retailers, sleep shops, why don't you guys just provide free naps? Why don't you run ads and say free naps on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, the days that are typically the quietest days. Have a little privacy screen, literally let people sleep in the store. I've been saying that for years. Everyone's kind of said, oh yeah, that's fun. And then Casper does it and they get great press. So good for them.
I guess they were listening.
You know, I'd like to think that.
We'll, you know what? We'll take credit.
We'll take
folks.
That.
We'll take credit for it.
Thanks, Casper.
There you go. But they're not the only one either, right? Brooklyn Betting is looking at brick and mortar. Nectar is very assertively going after retail placements.
They are. I was kind of surprised a year or two ago when Brooklyn Betting showed up at the conventional markets in High Point in Las Vegas, because they are a disruptor. And here they are at market, and who do they expect to see at market? They're not looking for online customers, of course, but they are looking to provide their expertise to the retailers who would shop at the, you know, who would be there at the market. And say Brooklyn Betting can say to the retailers who come in the space, they can say, hey, you want to have, you know, online's important? Guess what? We've got great online programs, and we will just provide them to you. So they're downloading or they're offering their expertise in a similar way. Nectar. Nectar is the fastest growing betting brand there is. And Nectar is going to make its first ever showing at the January Vegas market. And why are they there? Again, they see the value in brick and mortar. I think I'm thinking about saying something like this in a story on this. You know, what's the new secret of the online guys? It's bricks. I mean, you know, we've kind of thought, oh, these guys are in this esoteric world of their own. But I think they see the value of having brick-and-mortar stores. Nectar is going to provide details in the next couple weeks on their first 200-store rollout. And then Nectar will be in Las Vegas, as will Brooklyn Betting. So the good news here for a conventional retailer, furniture store or bedding sleep shop that has been trying to figure this out, hey, go sit down with the guys at Nectar. They're experts at driving traffic. These guys are now, they're right here at market. They're accessible. It's a chance for us in the press to sit down with them. But more important, it's a chance for retailers to sit down with other retailers, maybe not traditional retailers, but highly successful retailers. Nectar went from something like 40 million to 250 million. They're projecting over 500 million in sales this year. What retailer wouldn't want to try to figure out, well, what are some of the things that are going on there? So yeah, I think it's a tremendous opportunity when those online guys go to our traditional markets. They're opening their expertise up to the industry, and they want to do partnerships with people. So yeah, I think that's going to be a significant trend, and it goes to show, and you've said this at, I think, the last two leadership conferences, brick and mortar's not dead.
Well, you know, it's funny. We talk in absolute terms, right? We talk
about
millennials.
Like it has to be one way.
And we talk about all millennials are doing this. So we talk about everybody's, you know, leaving. If you look at the betting business, by most optimistic estimates, D2C is what? Box beds, 20%?
Well, the D2C channel could be 20. Yeah, could be 20 now. Not all of the online stuff is boxed, but a majority of it would be. So, but
which means you still have 80% going through brick and mortar. And I think sometimes we forget, because we talk from the perspective of the people who have owned that brick and mortar share, and for them to lose, for a traditional power player in that channel to lose 10% of their business or 15% to a player, that feels significant. That's something you need to react to. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that entire channel of distribution is about to evaporate.
No, but it's, you know, it's a sexy topic for analysts to talk about. What's the future of brick and mortar? And it's brick and mortar is always going to be here. Although there's one scary statistic that Mike Magnuson of GoodBed.com has shared, and that is that the percentage of people who say they have to try a bed before they buy continues to go down. I think now it's just slightly over half. It was like maybe up in the 70s. Now it's maybe in the 50s. That's not a good trend. If a larger number of people say, I don't have to try the bed before I buy, you'd like to think that. And I do think that you absolutely need to try a bed, just like I think you need to try shoes before you buy them or try clothes on, et cetera. But lots of people are happy to buy online and fix it later. Now, I will say this. There's a huge difference between buying shoes from Zappos and buying a mattress from Casper, whoever. The shoes are an easy return. The mattress, not so much.
Well, the other thing I think is I'd love to see somebody do some more sophisticated research and look at that by price point. Because I suspect that consumers are much more willing to take a risk on a $200 or a $300 mattress
or
from Amazon.
Say under $1,000.
Under $1,000. Whereas you get up around $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, I think that's something that there's a little more risk involved. You want to, you know, mitigate that. You want to lay on it, test it. And again, you know, we see the industry move a long way in a direction, and there's always, you know, the pendulum always swings back at least a little bit.
Well, let's talk about box beds for a second, because Earl Clough, who passed away last year, one of the big losses in our industry. When I sat down with Earl in my last talk with him, he was telling me he just could not understand why consumers would want to buy a really high-end bed online. He did not think that's how the online, the high-end bed should be sold. But that's really going to be a question. Could there be a Hastings boxed bed? And Hastings, by the way, is going to come to the Vegas market in January. Could there be a Hastings boxed bed? It's a little hard to think there could be. So I think you're right. The expectation level is lower on lower price products, and it's probably higher on higher end products. And so maybe the box beds are going to be largely limited to promotional and maybe some medium price points. At the high end, it's just not clear that the high end consumer is going to want that kind of a product. They're probably going to want to have a higher touch and feel.
High touch experience.
Yeah, high touch experience.
I think it probably behooves all of us to try to avoid talking in absolutes, right?
I absolutely agree.
All right, perfect segue, Dave. Let's talk about Vegas. Okay. As we record this, we're about a week and a half away. This is the Super Bowl for the betting business. You have been spending days and days and days cranking out stories on all of the things that are going to be there. What are some of the things that are catching your attention? It looks to me like we've got a lot of new technology coming into the market.
Well, I think there's nothing revolutionary, although a couple companies are telling me what they have is revolutionary, but it's certainly evolutionary, and the evolution continues in the adjustable bed category. One of the not great trends, in my view, is we're going to see more starting price point models. Again, I'd like us to sell better goods instead of cheaper goods, but I understand that as you lower prices into the 400 range, that you expand the market for that. But that's one of the things that you're going to see is new promotionally priced adjustable bases, but you're also going to see higher priced adjustable bases. So a lot of activity in adjustable beds. The cooler sleep category also continues to, cool down, but cool down sounds bad, but that's the goal here.
Oh, come on, that's a great headline. Cool beds get hot.
Cool, there you go. So that's what's going on there. And one of the interesting introductions in Vegas is going to be the new Tempur-Pedic Breeze line. They've got a new talking point, and that is all-night cooling, not just kind of the cool that you feel as you drift off to sleep, but a bed that keeps you cool all night. And they're saying they've done some groundbreaking study in this area. They've got a sleep climate lab at their Trinity campus that I'm anxious to see that really digs into these issues. And they say they have new technologies that will provide a cooler night's sleep throughout the night. So it's funny, there's been all this talk about cool sleeping beds. There's probably never been as much of it as we're going to see this market. And companies, Beautyrest has a whole system of cooling technologies in their new Beautyrest Black line, including taking something that we consider bad, namely black ice, but they're using it in a positive way, and they've got a black ice technology in the new Beautyrest line. So we're going to see more cooler sleep. We're going to see alternatives to China. There's a lot of concern that China is going to have major anti-dumping duties. As you know, the whole tariff situation with China is up in the air, but there's 10% in effect now, and it could go up to 25%. The industry, I think, did a pretty good job of minimizing the impact of that first 10, but the additional 15 would be significant. So a number of people in Las Vegas are going to be saying their message is, hey, we can provide you products from tariff-free countries. And who are those? They're Mexico, and I was down in Mexico to see one of those tariff-free factories a few weeks ago. Vietnam, there's a lot of buzz about Vietnam. I was in Vietnam a few weeks ago to see a tariff-free factory there. Indonesia, Malaysia, there's a lot of other alternatives to China. Now, the challenge is no one country can replace China. China's been built up over decades, as you know. And so Vietnam is not going to be the next China. On the other hand, Vietnam can be a nice alternative if China is under threat, which it is under threat. There are limits to the infrastructure that Vietnam offers compared to China. But still, Vietnam is going to see growth. Mexico is already the second largest mattress trading partner with the U.S. behind China. And so I think Mexico is positioned to grow.
What does it mean for the domestic bedding manufacturers?
Well, the domestic guys are excited about anti-dumping duties. And
especially since they're the ones who petitioned for them.
They did. Eight domestic companies got together and petitioned. And what they're saying is that they believe that China's been doing unfair trading practices. And I'm not sure anyone in the industry would say, well, we think it's okay for a country to have unfair trading. So that is the charge. That's going to be investigated. The industry observers believe substantial duties will be put on Chinese mattresses. Don't know exactly what those numbers would look like, but the indications are they would be big numbers. And again, China won't go away. And I think here's an interesting question we should kick around for a second, and that is, okay, say China is going to be challenged on its pricing. Could China reinvent itself as a higher-end producer? Or is it just so well known as a value supplier? What do you think?
I think that's a really good question. And I think China could absolutely reinvent itself as a high-end producer. I think if you look, there are some Chinese companies now in the furniture space that are producing some very high-end goods. The technology is there. And it does give them the ability to deliver great value at a higher price point, right?
Right, because the margins can be that much higher.
Yeah, and you can deliver more relative to what's there at that price point. I think we've seen that in a couple of categories in the furniture business. So that raises some interesting question about what happens to the opening price point. Does the industry vacate those price points? Do they go somewhere else to get those price points? I don't see anybody walking away from an entire pricing tier.
You know, I've been wrestling with this. Let's just say that Amazon, which is the major supplier of Chinese mattresses to U.S. consumers, they're about $1 billion in mattresses. So let's just say that half of that business went away. I'm not sure that, other than it would be very bad for Amazon, I'm not sure how bad that would be for the U.S. market, because a lot of that is at promotional prices, and those are not great beds. I worry that the expectations consumers may have on those beds may not be met. I don't know that they have excessive expectations. However, the mattress is such an important product. It's really a health product. It's a wellness product. Of all the places, you don't want to skimp. And what's one of the old-time sayings? You should not skimp on shoes, chairs, or mattresses, because you're either standing, sitting, or sleeping. So I don't know. I'm not sure it would be that bad if there was less promotionally priced product available. But is that a heretical thing to say? Or?
Well, I hate to say this on the record, but I have not been historically an opening price point shopper. I have covered consumer products for 30 years, and it has always been my experience, and I've said this publicly in columns, in order to hit the lowest price point, something has to come out. And typically that's...
Excellent point.
Typically, that's something that improves performance, improves durability, improves longevity. So you have to make sacrifices.
Yes.
That being said, there don't seem to be a shortage of consumers for that price point. If you look at Walmart's biggest competitor these days, the people that give them fits, other than Amazon, it's dollar stores, right? It's Dollar General and the other dollar stores. So there is a market for lower-end product.
Well, one interesting question is, has Amazon created new bedding customers with this plethora of low-priced mattresses? If they've actually expanded the market, that would be probably a good thing. It's really hard to figure that out, and the general thought is that the online guys are actually taking business away from other people. So I don't...
It's hard to see how you expand the market for something like bedding in the sense that
everyone has a bed,
has to sleep somewhere. So, I mean, if you can accelerate the replacement cycle,
right?
Maybe you expand the market that way.
Well, here's an interesting question. If we're selling more and more promotional bedding, by the definition of those products having something taken out, perhaps those products will accelerate the replacement cycle. I'm just not sure that's a good thing, though. If beds are going to wear out more quickly, that kind of bothers me.
Well, the other thing that would be a concern is, do you start to condition the consumer to say, well, it's good enough?
Yes.
And I at one point covered the coffee maker business. I was there for the Keurig invasion.
Oh,
and
that must have been fun.
Well, it was fascinating because they completely disrupted the market. Right now, in total dollar volume, single-serve coffee makers are actually a bigger segment of the market than traditional drip, like in the Mr. Coffee style. And that's a convenience play. If you drink a really good cup of coffee, a cup of Starbucks coffee, tastes, no offense, Keurig, but it tastes better than Keurig. If you brew a good pot of coffee, it tastes better than a Keurig. However, it's convenient. I take a pot, I pop it in, I push the button, I put in water. But you train the customer to expect or accept it's good enough at this price, it's good enough at this convenience level. Are we doing the same thing in bedding where they're saying, well, you know, it's $200, it's good enough, I don't care if I have to throw it out after 2 years?
Well, I think lowering length of mattress expectations might not be a great thing. You know, it's good and bad. The thing is, if right now the average mattress life is maybe 9 years or something like that, the challenge is you want to sell beds more frequently, but do you really want to sell them based off the mattress collapsing or being uncomfortable? Or one of the tricks, I think, to selling beds more frequently is to talk about the hygiene factor, namely things like dust mites. And whatever you like, do you really want to keep something for years and years? Take your favorite shoes. Do you keep shoes for years? Is there anything that you really keep for years? Your house, your spouse, hopefully, a mattress maybe.
You know, it's a funny thing. That is actually an old door-to-door vacuum cleaner seller trick. The Kirby guys, they do this. They come into your house and they vacuum your mattress. And what they do is they take this beautiful, pristine white pad and they put it over the intake valve. So
okay.
That all, you know, as they vacuum, it sucks into this pristine white pad. And then they take it off and they show it to you. And all there's that, you know, that skin and all of that stuff. And you look and you're like, oh, my God, I'm sleeping on that.
Yeah.
And so you shell out $1,000, right?
Yeah. So it can be a vacuum cleaner play too?
Well, I mean, maybe that's...
Well, it could.
Maybe
be.
That's a play down the road for the vacuum people is, you know, they've always talked about comfort, the aspect of better sleep.
Right.
But maybe there is a wellness play. Maybe there is a health discussion to have around that. And maybe that's the way the industry evolves.
Yeah. Before we go, and I know our time is creeping on, you came into the industry. You had a lot of experience in housewares and appliances. When you look at mattresses, what has struck you as someone? You've been in the industry now for several years, but what are some of the things that kind of strike you as a seasoned trade journalist looking at some of these new categories?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The mattress business to me is much more familiar than the furniture business. And by that, I mean it's branded. There's a good deal of marketing. There's a good deal of advertising. And the manufacturer's brand matters. If you're Tempur-Pedic, the consumer knows that name and they ascribe a value to that. And truthfully, you're not a brand if somebody's not willing to pay more for you, right? I mean, you can say you are, but at the end of the day, the real value of a brand is convincing the consumer that it's worth it to pay more to have that brand. And whether it's Tempur-Pedic, whether it's Sealy, whether it's Serta, whether it's Simmons, the brands go on and on and on. You don't see that in the furniture space. You also look at marketing. The mattress industry is very, very sophisticated in their marketing. I mean, the concept of better sleep.
Right.
I think the furniture industry, and I've said this since I got here, could learn a lot from the mattress business. Mm-hmm. How much time do you spend sitting on your backside? I mean,
yeah.
In whether it's your office chair or your sofa or your dining
right.
room chair, I think there's a story there to tell around comfort and wellness and ergonomics mm-hmm. that the furniture industry really doesn't tell. You have a segment of the population, I just turned that evil age of 60 this year, there's a whole generation of us who are starting to head into that age where comfort matters, convenient, you know, that the ergonomics matter. So I think there's an opportunity for the furniture business to take a lesson, take a page from the bedding book, and sell better seating, better quality of life. So I think I really love the bedding business. It's fascinating.
It's a very dynamic category. One of the things that bedding does is it really reinvents itself all the time. And, of course, some people have a cynical view and just say, oh, it's just all marketing. Well, what is the rise of Casper? It's largely a story of marketing. You know, you talked about the power of brands. Casper didn't exist until 2014. So brands, one of the shocking things now is major brands can be created in a few years. It took Sealy over 100 years to get where they are today, and here's a Casper in four and a half years, and they're a major, major brand. I mean, that's both good news, and it's also kind of scary news, I would think.
Well, I think it speaks to the speed of change. I've done a couple of presentations, and if you look, for example, at how long it took the television to reach 50,000 users. I think it was something like 75 years for the phone, 50 years for the television. It took Angry Birds 19 days. Right? It took Facebook, you know, 3 years. So, yeah. I mean, you look at the accelerating pace of change.
Right.
I think that speaks to how quickly you can create a brand. And digital social media changes the game. If you think about the internet, it's democratization of communication. And this is the challenge we face in our business, right? We all went to journalism school and studied our craft for years and years. And then you get some teenager who has an iPad and a camera, and they're out there and they're democratizing the journalism business. Well, there are companies out there democratizing the marketing business, democratizing the betting business. Anybody with a good idea can get an audience. And it's just how effective you are at creating an audience in that Wild West kind of atmosphere.
I like it. We've gone from old Rome to the Wild West.
There you go. I'm mixing my metaphors left and
but
right.
But it's good. It's all good.
Oh, okay, Dave. Well, it's time for us to get ready for Las Vegas. I know
it
you
is.
Have a ton of work to do. I really appreciate you taking the time out to talk today.
This was a lot of fun.
Pretty soon I think you're going to be on the other side of the mic and people will be getting to hear you interview some folks. So.
Well, look, there are a lot of thought-provoking questions. I appreciate the forum. And to anyone who heard anything that I said that sounded weird, let's do a do-over at a date to be named later.
Yeah, this is unedited, unscripted. And so if we said something that offends you, let us apologize in advance.
That's right. I love the if I offended you in advance apology. Always a good one. All right. Thanks a lot, Bill. I enjoyed it.
Take care, Dave.
All right. Bye-bye.